the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Okay, now it's fair to say that we regularly talk at this time of the year about keeping pets indoors and various other top tips to avoid the bangs and smashes and all sorts of things that can be taking place, probably not just on November the 5th, but also all the way up until Christmas as well. Well, this year we've gone even further in terms of real wonderful advice, because we can actually welcome to the program with some amazing tips and indeed very thoughtful tips in terms of how to stay safe this particular time of year. It's the legendary one and only Fireman Sam. How are you, Fireman Sam?
Well, hello there, Alex. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very good indeed, and indeed privileged to actually be sharing some thoughts with your good self, especially about these tips for bonfire night, not just this year, but every year. I mean, astonishingly, 1 in 10 households are setting off their own fireworks over the weekend. That could be an invitation to disaster, can't it?
Well, I think we're going to be busy, if I'm honest. But, you know, it doesn't have to be too busy for us, is if everyone sort of follows some rough safety guidelines.
And indeed, so with 91% of mums and dads also claiming that it's important to teach children fire safety, let's start talking about those safety guidelines, because you've been very busy, Fireman Sam, and you've put together a whole range of things that really need to be borne in mind. So away you go.
All right. So listen up, everybody. Now, fireworks are exciting, but they can be dangerous, you know, because they explode. So listen to your grown-ups and, you know, remember to stay in a safe place, you know, far enough back from the fireworks. And if a firework doesn't go off, don't return to it. That's very important, because you never know what might happen. Sparklers. Let's talk sparklers. So sparklers are lovely and they're very, you know, a lot of fun to play with, but they're also very, very hot. So when you get one, plant your feet and don't run around with it. You know, you can just waft it where you're stood, and wear gloves. Always make sure that you're wearing gloves when you hold your sparklers. And once a sparkler has gone out, once it's not all bright and sparkly anymore, put it in a bucket of water, because it's still very, very hot. Also, when you're going out to watch a firework display or indeed stand in your back garden, make sure you don't have on any flappy clothes, no dressing up clothes. You need to be wrapped up nice and warm with stuff tightly wrapped around you. What else? Oh, yes. Stand a safe distance back from the bonfire itself. Don't poke it with a stick or throw stuff at it. I mean, if you're able to poke your bonfire with a stick, you're too close. Step back. And what else? Oh, yes. We're finding that an awful lot of people are filming bonfires and firework displays with their phones. But what that means is that they're much slower to react if something goes wrong. So put your phone away. You know, it's a beautiful firework display. Don't be looking at your screen. Be looking at the sky. You know, watch the amazing fireworks. Enjoy the moment around you and enjoy it with your friends and your family, you know, as a community. So, yes. That's a good one. And also, Alex, do you know what you should do if your clothes were to catch fire?
This is a very good point, Fireman Sam. Tell me, what should I do if my clothes catch fire? Should it be a case of don't panic?
Well, yes, don't panic. That's the first thing. The three words are stop, drop, and roll. So you stop where you are, you drop to the ground, and you cover your face with your hands, and then you roll over and over, and that will help extinguish the flames. And it also helps people get to you more easily, because if you're running around, which puts oxygen to the flames and makes it go, you know, sort of burn more, people can't get to you easily. Whereas if you stop and you drop and you roll, people can be with you in seconds. So yes, practice it in your front room, you know, drop to the carpet or whatever is on your floor, and have a roll around. It might seem funny, but it could save your life. So yes, give that a try, everybody.
Could even be seen as something that was used in the recent Rugby World Cup as well. Stop, drop, and
roll.
Well,
indeed. Indeed. But so, let's not get involved on that talk.
I was going to say, let's just avoid that for all sorts of reasons. But in terms of the actual thing, do you feel as though people are learning more and that people are better prepared for fire safety than maybe they were in the 20th century? Are we ready in the 21st century, or are the same silly mistakes, like, as you said, running around and basically having flappy clothes and so on, are they still being manifest on a year-by-year basis?
Well, certain things improve and certain things get worse. You know, I think people are learning, but of course you can never stop an accident happening. You know, sometimes you can be as sensible as you like and sometimes something will just go wrong. But, you know, if we all want to have a good night, then we just have to pay attention to a few rules. I would love it if one bonfire night, I just got to stay in the firehouse and have a cup of tea. That would be the best bonfire night for me ever. Yep. But, you know, just stay safe, everybody. Nobody wants to have a tragedy happen.
Well, you are Ponty Panty's favourite firefighter, so clearly that's an absolute definite yes from that point of view. No mention of barbecues, Fireman Sam. Some people actually like to have barbies as well for bonfire night. Presumably the same.
Barbecue, yes, absolutely. I mean, just be safe. You know, use proper fire lighters. Don't try to light it with anything other than that. Remember to obviously keep a safe distance. You don't have to be stood over it. Just stand back from it. And be careful with, you know, the sort of fat and juices spitting that can set on fire. You know, be careful around that as well.
And we just want to make it quite clear that when we're referring to Barbies, we're referring to barbecues and not the doll that obviously sometimes I'm sure that Fireman Sam meets Barbie could be a whole new era for a whole new world. That's a
yes, and quite flammable. So let's not bring her into the mix.
Well, there are thoughts that suggest that life was a lot simpler where we simply went to the greengrocers or the hardware store and they would provide all the material for us, etc. Clearly that started to change 75 years ago, and many would say we've never looked back, really. 75 years of the convenience store, a key significant moment in UK retailing history. But where are we heading in the next few years? Well, we're going to try and attempt to address that by speaking to TV presenter extraordinaire, Cherry Healy. How are you, Cherry?
Hello, thank you for having me on. Lovely to talk to you.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. I mean, clearly neither of us were around when the first store actually opened for business 75 years ago, but it presumably was as much of a sea change as people finding automatic shopping today with those dreadful words, unexpected item found in bagging area.
Everyone's favourite sentence.
Absolutely. Exactly.
I mean, it was huge. It was absolutely game changing. You know, Co-op were trailblazers. So 1948 in London, on the 12th of January, we have discovered today, instead of writing your shopping list and take it to the grocer and waiting and queuing and not being able to choose and look at the ingredients and change your mind, you stood and you waited while someone got your items. And Co-op completely blew that out of the water, and you were allowed to go into the shop and you were allowed to pick items off the shelf. And actually it bamboozled people so much they had to have someone in the shop explaining the system to them. But it was wonderful. It was freedom of choice. I mean, it was just a complete game changer. Post-war London, people are busy. People are working hard to rebuild society. They didn't want to stand in line and wait for someone to choose. Actually, people wanted to walk in, you know, people working hard. So it really changed the face of the high street. And they've been doing that ever since, really. I mean, actually, Co-op have now launched robotic deliveries in Manchester. They're trialing that. So they've been at the forefront of shopping, grocery shopping, since they were born in 1948.
I suppose for those folk who were around 75 years ago and they were trialling that first store, rationing was still in place. So presumably there were still issues there in terms of what they were allowed to actually purchase. But maybe like most things, we can thank or blame the Americans for this, because obviously the onset of the supermarket as such seems to have come over. I mean, we're looking in terms of how the shopping experience is changing. Clearly, we now see an awful lot of high street stores effectively no longer there, becoming extinct, going out of business because of the online experience. Is that where the future is, Cherry?
I think there's always going to be room for technological advancement, as there must be, but I think people cherish their high street. And as we've seen, if you don't use it, you lose it. So I think that local shopping, that daily shopping, that convenience store is a central part of the community. And it's not just, right, well, what do I fancy for supper? And I need some toothpaste. It's actually a really important part of the community. And for some people, that's the human interaction they get during the day. And I remember in COVID, that was the one thing we were allowed to do. And I absolutely cherished it. And I still do. You know, in most co-op stores, there's a great big pin board and it's covered in volunteer work of things that are going on in the community. Jeff's got a sofa to sell. I've lost my cat. You know, it's become a really important part of our human experience, because we don't really use a town hall. I mean, I haven't been in a town hall for a very, very long time, but I do use my local co-op in almost like a community centre. And actually, their app is brilliant. If you want to get involved in volunteer work, or if you want to, you know, you can donate money to the local charities. It's more than just somewhere to go and get your food. It provides a really important service.
Presumably, size is also of key importance, because there are certain mega stores that you almost feel as though if you don't suffer from agoraphobia before you go in there, you pretty well soon when you actually go in there, because they're so huge.
I mean, they're so great. Sometimes you just need to go and do a mega mammoth shop. But, you know, I have to say, if I need to do a big bulk shop, I'll go online and get it delivered. And I much prefer doing the day-to-day shop. I find I waste a lot less and it's better for my budget. So instead of buying something that, you know, I think I'm going to have in a week's time, but actually I end up by going out for lunch with my mum or my friends, or I've got filming, so I'm no longer at home, and I end up by throwing out packets of salad, and it's such a waste. I actually find my food budget is much, much healthier, much more reduced when I do daily shops, because me and my son, we always eat what we buy. There's no waste at all.
Which is sustainability carried to its logical conclusion. That's well said, Jerry. Now, in terms of actually the packaging in supermarkets, of course, again, from Lever Brothers soap products right the way through to Kellogg's and their famous cornflakes and multi-cereals and such like stuff, there do seem to be an awful lot of areas of choice, even in local convenience stores. And certainly the co-op is part of this. Do you feel that sometimes causes confusion, or is it a case of, well, you just got to go through the basic bargain routines in most cases, particularly when there's a cost of living crisis on?
Well, I mean, the choice anxiety is a real thing, but those smaller, is that something that someone suffers with? Then that's exactly the beauty of that local convenience store, because they'll be very carefully selected for different budgets. So you're not looking at 500 different hot sauces, you're looking at 5, and you can make a choice according to your budget. It's also because you're physically in store, you're able to see things you wouldn't normally choose. You're able to see the fruits and vegetables that are in season. You're able to shop with your eyes. You know, you're able to like really have a look and see what looks really great, good, what looks like great veg. And so you're often eating more seasonally. I know that since changing to a much more regular type of shopping, I eat more healthily, because that fruit and veg is, you know, I'll buy broccoli and carrots for that evening and I'll eat them, and it's fresh and it's there and it's not sitting in my fridge rotting. I think it benefits in every way. It benefits budget. It benefits if you do have a bit of choice anxiety. And also you can see little cheeky deals. You can see what's on offer.
Any thoughts on the future of the human experience? Because clearly one of the points of contact for many folk was actually the lady or the person or the gentleman on the cashier. And obviously with more and more stores taking a line of, as we said, those automatic tills and so on and so forth, there seems to be less chance for people to actually engage. Do you think that's something we need to address, or is it just a case of, well, that's progress, that's AI for you?
I think at the moment there's quite a healthy balance. I think in co-ops, there's always someone at the tills, there's always someone to talk to, there's always someone on store helping you. But yeah, if you're in a rush, like I often am, and if I'm being impatient, I really love those automated checkouts, blip, blip, and off I go. I don't always want to sit and chat, but sometimes I do. And I think at the moment, it caters to both of those different speeds.
I can't imagine you ever being impatient, Sherry. You always.
Oh, I am so impatient. Oh my gosh, I can't bear a queue. So, but then sometimes I'm mooching and I'm browsing and I'm just, you know, and I want to ask someone a question. So I think right now you've kind of got to have both.
I always viewed you as the epitome of a Zen shopper. But anyway, that's another line. Where can people go to find out further information about the 75th anniversary and indeed other facts of the joys of the co-op?
Co-op.co.uk. You can find out how to become a member. You can find out about how to get involved in the community projects around you and about the 75 years of the store.
And for folk who wish to follow your good self, Cherry, are you on most of the socials?
At Cherry Healy.
There you go. At Cherry Healy, TV presenter extraordinaire. Huge thanks and happy shopping, Cherry.
Thank you so much, Alex. Lovely to speak to you.
It's been a consistent line since the pre-pandemic days. We don't appreciate our pharmacists as much as perhaps we should do because they are our healthcare heroes. And to talk us through why it's important to really take on board the fantastic expertise that the pharmacy can actually provide for us, we're delighted to welcome from the National Pharmacy Association, wonderful Andrew Lane. How are you, Andrew?
Morning, Alex. I'm good. Thank you very much. Fresh from a COVID and flu vaccination operation that I was involved in yesterday, in fact, in the pharmacy.
Well, there you go. And I think this is something that people still tend to forget, that rather than obviously dealing with their GP and obviously the very stressed aspects of most general practitioners' work, that actually pharmacists are fully trained and are indeed, as we say, healthcare professionals.
Absolutely, yeah. We've been giving the flu vaccine, for example, for the last 10 years or just slightly more now. And we see, on average, about 1.5 million people a day through pharmacy doors across the country. So we see an awful lot of people for various reasons, of course. Some of them might be just coming in for advice. Some of them might be coming in for a flu or a COVID jab. Overall, very accessible, I think, is the key.
Indeed. I see at least 1.6 million people a day visit a community pharmacy for healthcare advice and treatments, which clearly, if that 1.6 million people, even a portion of that went to the NHS, there'd be much more problems with respect to that. So do you think the message is getting across then, Andrew, in terms of, as you say, we've been talking about this for the last decade, really, that pharmacists are just as capable, indeed, in many cases, possibly more capable than visiting your GP when it comes to the traditional ailments?
Well, certainly in terms of accessibility, we are there, we're open, and people are coming in daily, as we know. But there are a number of services now which we're starting to offer that the public might not be as aware of. So we have a blood pressure monitoring service, for example, for the over 40s. So if you are not on any current blood pressure medication, for example, you can come in, have a free pressure test. And that means then we can give you some advice. Also, we can give your GP a copy of your readings and just make the whole thing a lot easier to access. I think that's what it's all about here. You know, local pharmacies do provide a range of NHS services that people perhaps don't know they're there.
It's also worth noting that, as say, to qualify as a pharmacist, it's not just a case of you turn up, take an exam and then go away again. Basically, it is a fairly considerable journey to actually go on. So we're not dealing with pharmacists who are basically random chances picked out and say, oh, well, I'll just try this one here.
Absolutely. We've got a 5-year course for pharmacy, and many pharmacists opt to go into the community pharmacy where they see patients face to face. And we have a lot of trained staff to support that service, of course. It's not just the pharmacist who's extremely qualified, but we have an able team of qualified technicians that support the service. In fact, many technicians are employed in ensuring that the whole, making sure your medicine gets to you quickly, they are in the background doing that seamlessly. Perhaps the public don't see much of that. They'll access the pharmacy, they'll speak to the counter assistants often, and think that the only qualified person in the pharmacy is the pharmacist, and that's obviously not the case. So we have a range of people who are more than able to talk to the patient about their condition.
I see that half of us would describe a pharmacy as a healthcare environment, but just under a third of us would describe their pharmacy as a retail environment. Presumably it's a case of it's a blend of both, really, isn't it?
It is a blend of both. There are pharmacies available on the high street, as there are pharmacies available inside GP practices. So there is a blend. All those pharmacies, however, provide good, sound NHS services, advice to patients on a range of conditions. For example, we have one called the New Medicine Service, which helps people understand any medicines they might have been newly prescribed for their long-term condition. And you know, there are a raft of services like that that perhaps the public are not aware of that we can offer while they're in talking generally about their medicines.
And what drew your good self, Andrew, into the pharmacy industry as a career?
I think I like dealing with people frontline, and there's a buzz really in talking to people about their conditions. Equally, you know, it always amazes me how little people do know of what the pharmacist can provide. And for example, just yesterday I was giving a flu jab, and the question was, oh, can I have my COVID jab while I'm here as well? To which the answer was, of course, yes. So, you know, I think there are a number of things like that that the public just think they can just come in maybe for the flu jab, but weren't aware that they could get their COVID vaccination at the same time.
There you go. And where would you recommend people should actually go to find out further details about their local pharmacy and so on?
Okay, well, you can go onto our website, which is the NPA, and that's www.npa.co.uk. You will always find a range of our members on there. You'll also be able to look up in your local magazine on the internet to see where pharmacies are available close to you. I mean, you can just Google now, pharmacy open near me, and it will come up with where the old local pharmacy is there and available for you. And it'll give you the opening times. Many are open, obviously, extended hours as well, of course.
Andrew Lane, pharmacist extraordinaire, many thanks indeed, and keep up the excellent work.
Thanks, Alex. Much appreciated.
Okay, well, the temperatures are beginning to drop, and clearly we may well be considering what can we actually do in terms of heating costs and keeping warm this winter. Well, it seems that more than 10 million people in the UK can only afford to heat one room in their entire home this winter. So let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that that actually entails with two fabulous folk. First of all, Gas Safe Registered Engineer Elizabeth Saxton. How are you, Elizabeth?
Yes, good morning. Fine, thank you.
Excellent. And we've also got Gas Safe Register Rob Denman. How are you, Rob?
Oh, very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Rob, if we can come to you first, I mean, tell us a little bit about some of the findings in terms of this particular aspect that you know, people are obviously really concerned about the likely increase in fuel costs and so on. And so they're just considering, well, we'll just work in one room this winter.
Absolutely, Alex. So, well, I think the cost of living crisis is hitting all of us, and really many households will be reevaluating their household budgets this winter. Our research is showing that 4.5 million Brits are potentially at risk from heating just one room in their house with a gas fire. Mm. Now, we've got a team of gas safe inspectors, and the latest data is showing that one in two gas fires inspected by our inspectors were found to be unsafe. So we're asking people to make gas safety a priority and get their gas fires checked by a gas safe engineer.
Like Elizabeth. So Elizabeth, let's come to your good self, if we may. Just talk us through why it's so important to actually get those gas appliances checked regularly to avoid things like carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yes, well, yeah, you've just said it then. Carbon monoxide poisoning, it can kill. So it's very important to get things checked annually. I've seen it quite a lot out there now that people are starting to use their fires more without them being checked. So, yeah, it's very important that that's done.
And what are the signs of unsafe gas appliances? I mean, if people are sort of saying, oh, well, I think it's okay, but, you know, what kind of are the warning signals that really need to be addressed immediately?
So on a fire itself, you can have a look yourself at the flames. If you think that they're not burning correctly, you know, lazy yellow flames instead of nice blue flames, and then also the signs of carbon monoxide poisoning. If you're experiencing headaches quite a lot, feeling sick, and you've had your fire on, I would definitely be getting one, your fire checked, and you checked out as well by a doctor.
Rob, as head of professional and field services at Gas Register, is this a bit like painting the fourth bridge, that basically you're forever actually having to check appliances and sort it out just as you finish one set, you carry on for the next set?
So every gas appliance needs to be checked every year annually, and that's to make sure you've got full confidence that it's working safely. This is a great time of year to do it. We're just going into the winter period. Gas appliances are going to be used more. You need full confidence it's going to A, continue throughout the winter, and really importantly, that it's safe to be used. So now's the time to get it safety checked. Gas Safe Engineer, the easiest way to find a Gas Safe Engineer is to go to our website, gassaferegister.co.uk, or contact our team of customer service agents on 0800 408 5500. The average cost of a gas safety check, research shows, is about £60 to £90. So it's not too expensive. I appreciate people are on different budgets, but we would say make gas safety a priority this winter.
We talk obviously about making sure that your appliances are actually checked from that point of view. There are a few other tips that I think are worth noting in terms of how you're ensuring that health is maintained, including making sure that all rooms with gas appliances are properly ventilated.
Absolutely. So all gas appliances need fresh air to burn correctly. Gas fires in particular may have a ventilator in the room. At this time of year, people might be tempted to block it up. I know when I was out as an engineer similar to Liz, and Liz, you've probably seen this, where customers will put cling film over ventilators, or they'll put paper over it to stop that airflow, believing they're doing the right thing, you know, stopping drafts coming into a room and costing them more money. But the gas fire, like any gas appliance, needs fresh air to come in so it can burn correctly, and that the flue system, the chimney, can pull the products of combustion away from the room.
You should also possibly consider fitting an audible carbon monoxide alarm. Is that in addition to the things Liz described earlier in terms of obviously lazy flames and so on?
Absolutely. So first line of defense will be to get your appliance safety checked by a Gas Safe Engineer. Second line of defense, absolutely a carbon monoxide alarm in the room where the gas appliance is. I had a little look on the internet last night. I was a little bit out of touch with costs. They're ranging from about £15 for a battery operated one, right up to sort of £90 if you want it to be able to talk to your phone and send you alerts and so on. So that they'd be fitted on the wall, the ceiling, wherever the manufacturer's instructions say, a certain distance away from the gas appliance itself.
And also something which many people might not be aware of, the emergency control valve, knowing where that's basically located is important.
Absolutely. So if you've got any gas safety concerns, you need to know where your emergency control valve is. Now, this will be located next to your gas meter. So you need to know where your gas meter is, familiarise yourself where that location is, that you can get to it. It might be behind a box, a gas meter box. And next to the meter will be an emergency control valve and a direction label there telling you how to operate it, and a telephone number on who to contact.
And just a final reminder, Rob, in terms of people wanting to get their gas appliances checked, where should they go to find a Gas Safe Registered engineer?
Our website, gassaferegister.co.uk. Simply put your postcode in, the type of appliance you wish to have checked, and a list of locally qualified engineers will be appearing on the screen. Or you can contact our customer service team on 0800 408 5500.
Rob Denman, Head of Professional and Field Services at Gas Safe Register. And of course, Elizabeth Sexton. Indeed, Elizabeth Saxton, get the pronunciation correct there. A Gas Safe Registered engineer, of course. Huge thanks. And keep on keeping on, folks.
Thank you, Alex.
So let's assume you were an actress that actually decided to disappear mysteriously from public life some 30 years ago. Where would you go? Possibly Cornwall. Maybe you might actually seek out a young film executive called Kate to actually help resuscitate your career. Well, so far on the Midweek Driving On edition, we've heard from Fireman Sam. We've heard, of course, from the future of retail, and, of course, giving you some good advice in terms of actually how to cope with making sure your gas appliances are actually checked. So from one gas appliance to another. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. Richard Fitzwilliams, welcome to the programme. How are you, sir? And Lily James and, of course, Kristen Scott Thomas performing in the same play for a very limited period at a part of London or inner part of London called the Harold Pinter Theatre. Quite exciting, really.
Very exciting. And what has been extraordinary is the response, in fact, to this. Now, I do have to admit, you can have a guilty pleasure whereby you go to a play, you know the play is not particularly good, but you do rather enjoy it. And then you think back, and the images that come to mind, I have to say, are rather strange. I mean, this is played by Penelope Skinner. It's set in London and Cornwall. We meet Elaine, Kristin Scott Thomas. I've never seen her on stage before. And I missed her measure in Three Sisters. She's a star, a sort of Gloria Swanson-like feel to this, who disappeared from the stage for 30 years. She's been a recluse. She does have contact with her neighbour, Chris, played by Sarah Powell, and she's in Cornwall. She wants to make a comeback after three decades. And a young film executive, Kate, played by Lily James, is sent by her PR agency to get in contact. And the whole idea is to tell her story, who will tell it and how. Now, Kate is married to a successful film director, Greg, played by James Corrigan. She has a child, but the child was born in very, very difficult circumstances when he was away. And he's obsessed with having another. She dreads it, and he hasn't taken her views on board. And indeed, the marriage, as we see in the early scenes, is undoubtedly in trouble. He also doesn't particularly like her going away for her job. So early on, you're getting a male who's not only difficult, to some extent it sort of verges on a form of abuse. When she goes to freedom,
abusive males is the theme of your whole entire piece this week. So, we shouldn't actually be surprised at that, really. I mean, carry on.
No, you have a point, Alex. You have a point there. Well, she finds freedom, to coin a phrase, echoes of, as you know, Harry and Meghan, when she goes to Cornwall and meets Elaine. Now, this is the image that stays with you, and I have to say that it's really bizarre. Elaine appears looking like some sort of strange apparition, a sort of a bird with feathers. Obviously, she looks extremely nutty. And again, you've got this Gloria Swanson image of someone wanting to come back when they've in fact been a recluse and indeed are completely out of it. And she does wear rather weird clothes throughout. Kate becomes, well, she discovers her freedom. She's indeed, you get a feel that she's drawn to the neighbour, a sort of, there's vague hints of lesbianism there, whose wife has died. And what happens when her husband comes back to fetch her? He literally pitches up at the home, which is called Lioness, and of course the pun on that is rather obvious because this is...
But there's no football in the play whatsoever, Richard.
But they discover the sisterhood. I mean, again, it's a male who's undoubtedly taking no notice of his wife's needs, and also you've got an actress who's putting into the arena her story. The fact that the reason that she disappeared is, in point of fact, because she was stalked again by someone who was, well, a male and also a top film figure who was, in point of fact, someone who was clearly appalling. And it's perfectly true.
Not Mr. Weinstein again, surely.
Well, it's perfectly true that legally stalking was something that's been extremely difficult to deal with. That happens to be a fact. But equally, she disappears because she was so terrified of him and what might happen. She is somewhat strange because she has birds, and her birds are stuffed in a cage above her. And there are symbols in this lioness, the way it's being constantly battered by the waves and all the rest of it. Essentially, when Kate finds this, the three women, in point of fact, the neighbour and also Elaine, and wants to bring her child down and live with them, this play is getting into the realms of the absurd. It is enjoyable from the point of view of Kate a performance by Lily James that, yes, I thought that she does a comic turn rather well, and she has the prepperness that the role demands. Not a great deal of depth, maybe, but I don't think that it requires it.
Kristen, you can't say Lily James lacks depth. I mean, you know, she's got depths that are hitherto unplugged in terms of her range of depthness.
I don't know what to make of that comment, Alex, but I will say this is a very curious play, and it was summed up by an unfortunate experience. What happens when your understudy doesn't know the lines? Now, this didn't happen when I was watching it, but people have had quite a lot of fun with it. Apparently, the character of Sue, played by Doon McKitchen, she's the executive who sends Kate to try and find out about Elaine's life. Well, turns out that she's dropped out of the play, so the understudy pitches up and reads from a Kindle. The trouble is the Kindle sticks, so she has to disappear. So the play has had a lot of brickbats, to be honest, because at the Harold Pinter Theatre, a certain standard is required, and it appears that many people...
Richard, surely, I mean, having a pause is the essence of Harry Pinter, hence the Harold Pinter pause. So therefore, a device that freezes is simply engaging with the whole notion of Harold Pinter.
That's a very interesting interpretation, Alex, and I think you should put it in print. No, I mean, I enjoyed the evening. The problem is, thinking back, it becomes a guilty pleasure. And honestly, Kristin Scott Thomas does look ridiculous for some of it. Yes, she's a remarkable actress. She's had a brilliant career. She's one of my favourites, and I pay tribute to that. But Lily James, well, she's pretty good for what she has to do. But it's what she has to do, and the fact that this play, you've got an abusive, callous male, and you've got a device...
Hell surprise.
Well... You've got a device at the end of this, and I can't reveal for obvious reasons, but it really, really doesn't work. It's supposed to symbolize the way women and the public relations executive film executive who sends Kate to meet Elaine, she's totally under the spell of another male. We don't meet him, but again, he can control what story is told, and then you can imagine that Elaine is not going to get the coverage she would wish. I mean, this whole play is not a good play, and yes, it was a guilty pleasure that I had fun with it, but it should have been more than that. And again, we've got this... It's fine to have a feminist tract, but when you have males who become stereotypical to the point where he has dialogue that is a white male he's discriminated against, and you have the audience ahhing and oohing when he's given lines that are so clearly discriminatory, so as to speak. You could argue that. I mean, quite frankly, we know that the film stage, very, very difficult for women in so many ways in past decades. But I don't think that the light this play sheds on it, I do not think it is particularly constructive to be taken terribly seriously.
Natasha Watson, having just returned from last week where you were at the symbol of the oppressive male white patriarchy, the wedding, is this something which, in essence, you would say, yes, if I had a spare £53, it would definitely go on actually going to see this particular play? Silence. And we haven't silenced Natasha. She just needs to unmute herself. Otherwise, there'll be all sorts of problems in terms of lip reading and putting words into her mouth. There, that's better.
Can you hear me? Yes, you can hear me. Okay, sorry. I hate it when I feel like we're back at the start of COVID for a minute there. Yeah, lots to unpack there from what Richard was saying. I do like Pinter, but he is quite a controversial, he can be quite controversial in his material, and I get that he's probably not for everyone.
Sorry, just to interrupt, it was actually the play is
Penelope Skinner. It's just performing at the Harold Pinter Theatre.
But it was in the Harold Pinter. It was in the Harold Pinter Theatre. I misheard that. Okay. I do really like Lily James. I'm saddened to hear that she's not particularly got a lot of depth in this play. But then it sounds like from what Richard's saying that there's not really a lot of substance in general from what's going on, which is a shame. And it is something, unfortunately, that we're seeing a lot in sort of TV and sort of more film media as well, is that we sort of get these great sweeping sort of social construct ideas that sort of end up being kind of done a bit rough-handed and end up kind of having no so little substance when you actually peek underneath. So it seems like it's one of those kind of scenarios, and it would probably irritate me quite a lot to see the way that it's carried out.
On the good perspective, Natasha, at least we can say that we can say the word of the play itself in terms of Lioness. We certainly can't say the word of Penelope Skinner's first play, which was performed at the Old Red Lion Theatre, but begins with F and ends in D.
that.
And you know my feelings about the F bomb.
More about the perspective of the kind of the caliber of what we're maybe dealing with writing wise. Interesting. I don't know. Maybe I would not be a fan. But having seen neither of them, I probably wouldn't comment. But I think £53 is probably going to be a bit of a stretch for this one for me. Maybe if it was free, and maybe if it was
on
the concert.
It's from £53, so you can go up to about £100 if you wish, really. It's just that's the intro.
True.
Yeah, no.
On the other hand, of course, when we actually move into the cinematic world, we can obviously say, well, let's look at a killer of an application. And in particular, let's look at the way in which David Fincher, much known for, of course, the way in which he produces a whole variety of things. And especially when you actually look at the notion that the longer a killer waits for his target, the more he thinks he's losing his mind, if not his cool. How anybody could actually say that the killer in the David Fincher movie could possibly lose his cool, I really don't know, because it's Magneto from the X-Men, amongst other things. In other words, Michael Fassbender. But where do you put yourself in this particular role of Michael Fassbender, a very precise person who is so precise, he even actually ensures that he puts his earbuds in a nice balletic way, just to actually ensure that the music he listens to whilst preparing for his work is actually effectively put together and addressed. Is it one that Netflix is going to be desperate to actually screen in a few days from now?
Well, I have to say, it's a remarkable film, and you are going to get something unusual for David Fincher. He did Seven, which still has, well, it still chills
Don't
me.
Lose your head, Richard.
Thank you, Alex. But it's easy to lose one's head when one's thinking of certain aspects of David Fincher. Don't be too outrageous. You really, really are sometimes. Gone Girl, Zodiac, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The Killer is a worthy successor and a very unusual movie, because we meet a very mysterious figure. We meet him in voiceover, and he's setting up opposite an apartment, intending to assassinate a target. Now we learn that it's rather boring and can be cold, there's a routine nature to it, and so forth. And the target does appear. This is in Paris, and the film is divided into sections in the various cities, linked to cities. I'm not sure that that device works especially well, but it's interesting, as this is so unusual. When I can reveal this, because it's the essence of what follows, he shoots, but accidentally he misses, because in fact the target has arrived in the company of a dominatrix, and it's she who is killed. So he has to tell his handler, and then thereafter he returns. We see them in the Dominican Republic, to one of his hideout homes, and he finds it's been broken into, and his girlfriend Magdala has been attacked brutally by assassins. Now, that means He's got a lot of work to do. There's his job that he didn't finish. There's also the fact that he's got to ensure that this attack never happens again to Magdala, played by Sala Baker. And the only way to do that is to pay a visit on all those who were involved in this particular job. And that is where we meet a variety of very unusual people. I do have to say that when he visits a lawyer in New Orleans, he has unusual ways of making his point. And the lawyer, played by Charles Parnell, excellent performance, doesn't come out of it particularly well. Without going into the details of exactly what happens when he meets a variety of these individuals who for one reason or another are involved, there's Tilda Swinton, who's sitting at a restaurant. She's rather discombobulated when he pitches up. And, well, she knows that nasty things are likely to happen. There's also the character of called the Brute. The Brute is one of these characters who will fight you if you try and bump him off. Now, the fight scene, I mean, this is the sort of thing that this movie does, which is pretty realistic. It does slip because I notice in cinema, it's one of these things that when you have ferocious fights, very often the hero, a couple of days later or thereafter, hardly got a scratch. And it's the same sort of thing. It's one of the most vicious fights I've ever seen on screen. And here's the fact, hardly a scratch a little later simply isn't convincing, simply because you would get very bashed up if you... Well, if you pitch up at the Brute's home and try and kill him and he doesn't, he notices and things go a bit wrong, then you have a brutal fight. And then, of course, you've got to get to the client who began all this. All of this does draw you in. And I have to say that the scenes, the voiceover, the way the story is told through a voiceover, then we have scenes with individuals who talk in one way or another, and when they're being visited, I think it works extremely well, and visually it's pretty deft. The script is extremely good. I have pointed out a couple of flaws in it, but the main flaw in many people's views will be is the moral ambiguity of this. As you are drawn into his world, are you in fact sympathizing with a cold-blooded killer for no reason other than the fact that this is a very well-told story and that David Fincher is an excellent director? But he is in fact morally very, very ambiguous here, because as you're drawn into this neo-noir world, a psychological crime thriller, it's absolutely fascinating. But should you be, or shouldn't you be utterly repelled by what you see? So these are questions that if and when you see the killer, should be answered.
Natasha Wanton, is this something you just can't wait until it arrives on Netflix on the 10th of November?
I'm very interested in this movie, I've got to say. I mean, you've got Michael Fassbender and you've got Tilda Swinton, which is, I mean, a beautiful match.
Magneto and the Ice Queen.
Right, what more do you need? I can see myself getting very drawn into the plot of this as it sort of unravels. I like those sort of sticky, complex plots where you sort of have to unravel exactly what's going on piece by piece. And it sounds like it's one of those kind of movies, and it very much intrigues me. I'm fascinated by the questions as well that Richard was putting out in terms of, because it's such a good piece of storytelling, isn't it? When you've got these really grey, complex characters, and probably if you sort of saw a blank sort of printout of the, you know, their history and their past and everything, you'd sort of think, oh, they're a terrible person. But you get so drawn in because of the storytelling and the quality of it that you do sort of start to feel things for people and get very emotionally attached to people that you probably think are terrible. So it's a very interesting. It's a very interesting piece that I think Rich has put forward, and I am very intrigued to see it. I can see this also being one that my mum would get very hooked on. She loves this sort of interesting kind of grey, sticky characters. I think she'd be really into this. So I will definitely recommend it to her to watch as well.
And very good cast, by the way, I must say. Flawless performances by everyone, however they are threatened. It's fascinating to see fear portrayed in this way. But to what extent, as I say, are you drawn into his world and side with him? And should you? And by the end, I have to say that I was questioning my own attitudes. Is one amoral simply because a story is told as well as this?
But isn't that a great part of storytelling, Richard? And it's such great, it's really great when you see something of that quality that makes you question and think about that, because there's so many bland kind of churned out cookie cutter movies nowadays, and so to see something that does make you question your own morality and your perspective and the character, I think is really wonderful. Sorry, I'm getting very passionate.
I agree.
I have to say, I'm surprised that Richard decided to avoid reviewing the latest Trolls movie, but that's another issue for another time. And of course, Ridley Scott's take on Napoleon and Waterloo and Napoleon, of course, will be coming out very shortly. So that's good. Plus, of course, he's got The Marvels, again, another movie to probably avoid. The film that no parent wants to see, according to The Mail, and they should know, How to Have Sex Leaves Viewers Feeling Grubby, as critics hail eye-opening look at the reality of teenage girls post-exam holidays abroad. I think you can already guarantee that I'd be probably scoring this at about a 2.5 out of 10, despite the fact that it won a Un Certain prize at Cannes and received a standing ovation. Mark Kermode, he's a 60-year-old white male, self-admitted, basically said that deep-fried cigarettes, not necessarily for him, but at the same time, he appreciated the exciting dynamic of the whole system. Strangely enough, Sarah Huntley, no sign because she's travelling back, and of course, Thea van den Bogart, her parents have actually arrived to stop her even talking about this particular side of things in Holland. And likewise, Anna Coscanel, our newbie from Romania, has also had an unexpected holiday that she's had to go on. Hopefully not the kind of holiday we see actually portrayed in How to Have Sex. But if you wish to actually talk about coercion and indeed disconnection and a whole variety of other things and the patriarchal society and so on and so forth, Richard, please, you have 5 minutes.
Well, I would say How to Have Sex certainly has nothing to do, or very little to do, until...
It's not How to Guide.
Climactic scenes about action sex. It's a drama. It's written and directed by Molly Manning Walker, and yes, the film was received, as you mentioned, and fair enough, Alex. You mentioned Un Certain Regard at Cannes. It won. Again, I would go with what Mark Kermode says, because it isn't the sort of film that essentially appealed enormously to me, but it is extremely well done because you've got very good performances, and most particularly by Mia McKenna-Bruce, who plays Tara. Tara is one of three British teenage girls who go to a resort in Greece, and it's a rites of passage movie. They're seeking to get laid, drink, and living it up. And certainly the filming, the visuals are impressive, and it is very like, as I say, a documentary type movie. You certainly see all the detritus in the streets, and goodness me, some of the partying scenes, some of the drinking, Alex, and the after effects might not personally appeal to your good self. And some of the acting, though, it's very hard sometimes to believe that these are actors, because they are, but they are extremely good. It's a realistic portrayal, even if the characters concerned, or some of them, are certainly not the sort who I personally might hang out with if I had the choice, but very interesting portrayal by Mia McKenna-Bruce.
Molly Manning Walker, she directed it. She's the one who's taking credit, or indeed otherwise, for it.
She's playing a character who is coming to realise that there are complexities when you want to lose your virginity, and when it comes to the issue of consent, the film has got an interesting take on that. I'll say no more. It recreates sometimes rather sad moments, but it's got a vigor about it. It's got a drive which is very imaginative. It's an extremely unusual movie, and people who go believing it's full of sex or whatever are going to be disappointed. But these are excellent performances. And yes, Lara Peak as Skye and Enver Lewis as M as the other two of the trio, very good. And Samuel is played by Paddy Bottomley, and Badger by Sean Thomas. Both have important roles. Yes, it isn't a particularly flattering look at the males and the male egos, but nonetheless, what you have is an awakening, or an awakening beginning, in a character who's played extremely well. So it's not my sort of movie, I must admit, but it is well done.
And based on the autobiographical experiences of the director, Molly Manning Walker, who herself suffered...
loose autobiographical, yes, that is claimed.
Again, the worst kind of the human experience. Natasha, I'm sure you'd turn around and say, but it sounds like an average day trip after we did our A-levels in Nottingham, surely. No, hopefully not.
Oh, no. I don't think that this is particularly one for me. I don't believe that I might be particularly the target audience, though, either. So probably one that I will probably give a miss. There are a lot of other movies I'm looking to see right now, and this probably isn't one of them.
Well, again, I think it's an area where clearly it raises a number of very important issues. I'm not sure whether in raising those in the form that it actually does, which moves from the glossy to the very, very disturbing, it necessarily is the best way forward. But having said that, the award it did win at Cannes is literally given to a film that people don't really know. It's called Uncertain because people don't quite know which category to actually put it in. That's why it's Uncertain. Clearly, the message is there. Anyway, that's pretty much it then. I think Fireman Sam probably stole the day for me at the start of this particular piece, but there we are. That's Fireman Sam. To Richard Fitzwilliams, to Natasha Wanton, huge thanks. And until next time, keep watching those movies.